This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to Circus Maximus. Today is September 9th, 2016, and this is Renegade Broadcasting. And you can connect with our chatters over at renegadebroadcasting.com and create a name if you don't have one. There's a bunch of chatters already over there already. And tonight we are going to be covering the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and I have a special guest, Ryan Dawson, and I'm going to read his bio real quick. Ryan Dawson is a historian from the College of William and Mary with 16 years of political activism in a variety of mediums, blogging, radio, books, film, and television. He's been on Russia Today, Press TV, CNN, Headline News, MSNBC, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Al Jazeera, Anti-War Radio, Eddie Bravo Radio, George Galloway, Pat Buchanan, and a variety of other radio shows and podcasts. And he's the webmaster and host for the ANCReport.com, which features podcasts and politics and economics with professionals from around the world. He's also got a forum that I was already aware of back in 2008, where I visited on a frequent basis. That's Rise 2cents.com, R-Y-S, the number 2, S-E-N-S-E.com. And I came across Ryan's work back in 2008. A lot of the Ron Paul revolution type of information was coming out at that time. And I was digging into 9/11 and found that his research by far is some of the best out there. So, Ryan, welcome to the show tonight.
Hey, thanks. So you were on the forum a long time ago. That's cool.
Yeah, man. I met a lot of people back in the day with MySpace, and that's how I connected through you through that with Converse and Jonathan Azizai and a bunch of other people that were heavily involved with 9/11 research. And I know that the Missing Links documentary opened up my eyes, but your research even goes a lot further than where that movie went.
Missing Links. Missing Links is my research because all they did was rehash a paper from William Pierce and take sections out of Welcome to the USSA and made it a movie.
Excellent. Yeah, and I know
I distanced myself from those guys because I was helping Mike Delaney with that. And then around 2008 or 2009, he just became like suckered into this Christian identity thing and became a full-on racist. So I was like, whoa, it wasn't like that when I first met him or anything. Met his wife.
I met his wife too, and himself. And I also met John Allen Martinson back in 2008. I had a really bad vibe when I met those guys. I didn't really have a good feeling. They were putting together this off the grid project to generate funding, stating that they were going to have this land set aside through the Lakota tribe. It was kind of like going off this whole vibe that the Lakota tribe broke free from the Federal Reserve, and they're playing into that, playing on people's emotions to generate funding.
They tried to pull a Ken and Keith.
Yeah, we've been having a radio host by the name of Graham Hart on our network covering that angle and having some of that information and the interviews that have been taking place with that. It's a whole mess, man.
Well, that guy was telling me back in 2013 his plan to buy land, and I'm like, why? That doesn't help anything but you.
Yeah, exactly.
And people can't just quit their jobs and go move to Dominica, you know, like just for what? To avoid taxes? Like, they'd save way more money paying taxes than they would.
I agree.
And I'm like, you could just move. Like, I live in Japan. My taxes don't pay for war. It's constitutionally forbidden. It was just silly. And I don't know what is the thing, you know, all the scandals, but because I broke off with him back in 2013.
Yeah.
Because he was, one, he was totally anti-Semitic. I mean, just Jew this, Jew that. And he's like, why don't you say Jew? I'm like, because it isn't. It's not some genetic disposition to behave this way. It's Zionism, which is an ideology, totally different. I mean, it's like saying liberals genetic or something. It's, and then also he believes space aliens build ancient structures because he saw it on a TV show. And he fell for Judy Woods and justification and all that. And I'm like, all right, you're basically just an idiot. Like, and he actually age-bashed me on that. He's like, when you're older, I'm like, holy. I forgot more about 9/11 than that prick will ever know.
Oh yeah, and
$100,000. I'm like, what are you doing with it? It's like, if I had like 3,000 of that, I'd make a film, which I end up doing anyway on my own. But I'm like, what are you doing with this money? They raised all this money, have nothing to show for it. They built like 3 walls of a classroom, didn't even finish it. It sat there for a year, like undone. And he was just all playing in Hawaii. But that's that.
So. Oh, Kenan Keith, he's over in Ohio. I thought he was still in Dominica, but
yeah. Oh, he's in Dominica now. I'm talking about way back in the day when they drew on the beach, and then it's sad, man, because I want to help Palestine, and you want to believe people who are you know, pontificating on these speeches about honor, integrity, and truth, and justice, and peace, and blah, 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 that. Okay, let's do something, but they never really had anything concrete. You can't just say I have a plan for 10 years. And then when I heard the plan, I'm like, you're going to move to Dominica? Like what, and build a little haven, like a cult where people can go down there and not pay taxes? I'm like, that is not worth a dime. You could do that anyway.
Right, exactly.
Just go move to Dominica. Well, you don't need a leader to help you with that. Like, you could go rent a house there. You don't need to buy land if you're just trying to avoid taxes.
Totally sounded like the project off the grid, but on massive steroids.
Exactly. He was like, I mean, at least they were trying to help the Lakota, though. Like, I think that was sincere, at least from Mike Delaney's part, and they just washed their hands of it. But,
well, yeah. Plus, a lot of interesting things were coming up about John Allen Martinson with a lot of different scams that he was involved with.
He's a con artist.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
They stole my War by Deception graphic and all of the information and just added a bunch of Jew bashing bullshit to it. So there's nothing original there. Like, they can yell loud or whatever and drive around with a bus with, you know, the logo painted on it and stuff. But they didn't know any of that stuff until after they talked to me and saw me and read, I had half of War by Deception out already, but I already had it written on the forum. As you know, it was called Iraq 9/11 PNAC, All Roads Lead to Israel. And I'd connected that the Iraq Anthrax and the Dancing Israelis, all that already. I did that back in 2004.
Wow. Actually,
you know.
Excellent, man. Now, your new film that I got to see, phenomenal, excellent, The Empire Unmasked. I think that it's 5 hours pretty much. That covers the Latin American involvement, kind of like a template for what's been utilized for the Middle East. And you've gone into just about every intricate detail that involved 9/11, the before, the staging of it. A lot of events were building up to that happening.
I even told you what Omar Mamari had for lunch. Which is interesting to me because it was a ham sandwich and he's not very kosher, but whatever.
Yeah, I just heard that. I was watching that again for the second time, and that just that part in the segment of the movie just happened about an hour ago. And just to hear that somebody who is supposedly Jewish actually ate a ham sandwich, that just tells me that the religion aspect doesn't really mean shit. So as far as
religion is Israel and the Holocaust, that's their real religion. It's not Moses anymore. It's more of this like victimhood identity.
Absolutely. And you see that in the news now. You see that in the news a lot now with the UN meetings that they've been having related to the online anti-Semitism going full steam and what they're going to do to stem that off, and having the representatives from Facebook and Twitter and all the other different social networking.
And by anti-Semitic, they mean anything against Israel.
Exactly.
People. I mean, anything that, you know, oh, you won't support our ethnic racial colonies, so you're racist. It's so backwards.
So what do you think? Have you met any Jewish people that were decent people that you would be able to feel comfortable around and kind of trust in a way?
Of course.
All right. I wasn't sure if there was that group of people over in Japan so much.
In Japan. Of course, I thought that was a silly question at first. You meant in Japan. Well, I don't meet a lot of foreigners in Japan. And I don't know if someone's Jewish or not because I never ask. Like, it's not like – well, I guess in America, the diaspora, it's kind of like vegans. They'll let you know they're vegan immediately. And a lot of Jewish people just got to tell you they're Jewish. Like, you give a damn. Like, you know, I'm Jewish. I'm like, that's nice. You know, like, I don't care.
Yeah, they do. I know Japan is pretty much –
but outside – yeah, people – there's a filter here. Like, the kind of people who come to Japan are – you know, the kind of people who travel anywhere, I'd say, are a little bit more worldly and not, you know, hung up on stuff like that. So,
I know Japan itself is about 97% homogenous Japanese. Is that about right?
Yeah, it's in the 90-something percent, yeah, right. I would say.
All right. And then –
that's off the – it might be around 90% because they count a lot of Koreans as Japanese even if they're
– oh, okay.
You know,
I see. I see. So I wanted to really dig into your movie, your documentary, The Empire Unmasked, and kind of lay the groundwork for our audience and how the buildup of 9/11 was occurring with the sanctions in Iraq and the starvations that were occurring and the Clean Break and the PNAC group, the Project for a New American Century, and a lot of other aspects. I even know that there's a lot of predictive programming happening in Hollywood with different incidences of buildings crashing into towers. You had Operation Northwoods, I think, is something similar that kind of was a familiar type of PSYOP or plan that was going to be utilized against Cuba. You even had
they named the Aspen Institute after Paul Nitze, too, who was one of the architects of Operation Northwoods.
Excellent.
And that's where Libby and Pearl are all fellows there. These PNAC people all join these Aspen Institutes too.
Okay. And then you also had one of the founders of Mossad, Isir Harel, saying that there would be a rise in terrorism and an attack in New York during an interview back in 1979. So there's been a lot of predictive programming occurring way before 9/11 even happened. So let's get into, let's say, the Clean Break and the buildup in Iraq first.
Well, Clean Break is still sort of starting in the middle. That's Richard Pearl, and that's an important person because he becomes the chairman of the Defense Policy Board in the Pentagon, and he's the chair for Defense for Policy in general. Within that, there's a board, though, and he's the chair. And, you know, that's like, I'd say, number four in the Pentagon. They don't really have a clear rank, like, you know, who's... is the Army Secretary higher than the Navy Secretary or not? I mean, those are all pretty even, but he's on that second tier, I'd say. And this guy is mainly talking about how they have to invade Syria. But before they can get into Syria, they have to handle Iraq. But the bulk of the Clean Break document is about Syria, and it's basically what we're doing now. However, this policy paper, and he has grammatical mistakes, by the way. I'm just pointing that out because it's not very long, and this is how stupid this guy is. But this is standing on the shoulders of a much larger paper by Oded Yanan,
yes,
which is a strategist, and that wasn't even published in English. An Israeli whistleblower did that for us, but Oded Yanan really laid out Iraq the most. I mean, they talked about how to divide it up in by sectarian lines with the Kurdish area in the north and the dividing Sunnis and Shiites and getting them to fight each other. And this was during the Iraq-Iran war. They already planned, like, let's level this out because the Israelis and the Americans, the Israelis assisted the Iranian side and the Americans assisted both sides. And they had plans for Saddam, but the CIA had already worked out, like, look, we're going to support the Ba'athists as a bulwark against the communists. So Saddam was their boy. And they gave him mustard gas and everything else. There's a kind of infamous picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking Saddam's hand. And you can see McFarlane in the background, too, Iran-Contra. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know now, too, that the Israelis and the Americans were covertly working with each other at that time for Iran-Contra in secret. That started in 1980. So prior to the Iran-Iraq War, the U.S. and Israelis are already working together and selling parts to the Iranians. The Iranians needed to upgrade their planes, mostly their airplanes, their warplanes. So it started real subtle, like, okay, they sold them some tires and things like that to make sure this network would work. And the Israelis were the middlemen because of the hostage crisis. The Americans can't deal with them directly, obviously. Mm-hmm. So their black market way was going through the Israelis. And the Israelis already had a network in place because who do you think it supported Shah to begin with? You know, that Israel was getting 90% of its oil from Sinai and Iran. Israel and Iran, during the Shah period, had built a pipeline that went to the Red Sea, which offsets the Suez Canal, which is why the British had supported Israel and the Zionists to begin with, was they didn't want to lose the Suez Canal after World War II. Well, that's a long story. But anyway, the Iranians and the Israelis had a really good relationship prior to 79. After the revolution, it's out. But they're still trying to work with that faction, their own faction that was left over, and get a return. So Iran and Iraq go to war for 8 years, tear each other apart. The U.S. balances out. They make sure, you know, Iraq and Saddam are in place, and they supported Saddam, which is amazing. They're going to turn on him shortly after the war, though. They'll have the first Gulf War. But at this time period, the Oded Yanan strategy is laying out, look, we're going to have – Iraq is a bigger threat than Iran to Israel. And we're going to have to divide them, and this is how we can do it, and we can cause sectarian infighting. And they spell it out. And they even at one point dreamed of a pipeline to Haifa. That never happened. But all the pre-war lies in, throughout the 90s then that you're going to get from Paul Wolfowitz and Pearl and all the PNAC group, all the Weekly Standard people, Robert Kagan, William Crystal, a bunch of dual citizens with Israel, reiterate the talking points from this plan. And then you'll see in the 2000s, all they did was rehash old lies. Like even the little, oh, he's 6 months away is always 6 months away, right?
Number six.
Was just verbatim stuff they had already written, and they're passing it off like it was new news based on new intelligence. And what they had this little triangle set up between the government in waiting, the Iraqi Congress, the INC, the National Congress, and a couple of moles in the New York Times, like William Sapphire and Judith Miller. Judith Miller blamed everything on Iraq, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
93 bombing, Iraq. Oklahoma City, Iraq. Like, yep. Everything, Iraq. She's very predictable. Anthrax, too, but I'll get that in a minute.
Yep.
So they set up this triangle where basically these moles were quoting the INC, and the INC were being fed the information by this PNAC group. And then PNAC would then quote the New York Times, and you're like, see, it's in the New York Times. But it's really stuff they wrote themselves, you know, and just pass it to INC, pass it to her, like Miller or whoever, and then these guys quote her. But they're quoting themselves. And it was all rhetoric that they had already said in the 90s, and it was all the lies that they had taken from Oded Yanan. So Oded Yanan's really the start of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then Clean Break was written after that, where they wanted the Hashemites in Jordan, and almost everything Clean Break wished has happened. And they thought, it seems like after the Iraq War, they thought, all right, now's our time to smash Hezbollah. And there was the assassination of Rafiq Hariri in Lebanon, because Syria had troops in Lebanon at this point, you know, because Israel tried to invade in 82.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the famous, you know, Reagan got us out of there, the bombing in Beirut, and so on.
They were also messing with Assad's father during that time, too, during that.
Right, and the Muslim Brotherhood was having a war with Assad's father at the time. And Assad's father retook 30% of the Golan Heights, which was territory that Israel had previously annexed. So they didn't get all of the Golan Heights, but about 30% of the Golan Heights has been returned to Syria. And Syria keeps their troops in Lebanon. And so then after the assassination of the prime minister, which was blamed on the Syrians, they were exonerated. But during that process, because of all the pressure from the Brits and the Americans, Syria on paper withdrew their troops from Lebanon. And immediately, I mean, within months after, Israel invades Lebanon in 2006, assassination was 2005, 2006, they invade, and the Lebanese military didn't lift a finger, and there are no Syrian troops. It's just a one-on-one with Hezbollah, and Israel still lost.
Yep.
Because they lose 100 people, and they give up. Everyone's okay. You know, they have compulsory service. And, you know, they support war as long as they're going to completely dominate and not have any casualties. They're used to attacking kids throwing rocks in Gaza. And so they did kill more people. They killed about 1,000 civilians in Lebanon. But army-to-army-wise, Israel lost more soldiers than Hezbollah. And they attacked the Christian areas of Beirut, which was a big PR mistake because then the Western media completely flipped on them. And so Israel could not make it a quick war, so they went to Plan B. And Plan B was what Clean Break had said they needed to do from the beginning. They said it's not enough to one-on-one on Hezbollah because Hezbollah is supported by Iran and Syria. This is the resistance access. What I'm saying right now has been said by the Hezbollah commander, by the way, that they go into Syria, which would create a wedge between Iran and Lebanon. They have the backing now of a lot of these MIC profiteers because Syria had signed on to a $10 billion pipeline to go from the Pars fields in Iran through Syria out to a port, which would allow them to compete with the current BTC line near monopoly, non-OPEC oil and gas, that starts in Azerbaijan and comes through Turkey and then goes by sea to Israel and slides through their old pipe in the Red Sea and goes to China and India. That's the big market. And so you've got these overlapping interests. So they're like, all right, now we've got the opportunity because we've got big energy on board. We've got the MICs always on board. So the Zionists seize that opportunity and go, let's roll out our plan now. Iraq is finished. They're torn up, 100 people dying a day. They're no threat anymore. They can't support Palestine anymore. They've got a Shia proxy government in charge, and so we'll go into Syria. And then that all started with the, you know, assassinating policemen and snipers shooting at people. It was not like some popular uprising or anything like that.
Oh, no, same with Libya.
Same with Libya. I mean, same with, like, Ukraine, Operation Ajax in 53. Mm-hmm. I mean, you buy a rent-a-crowd, and this is how they roll. And that's what they did, and now we have conflict in Syria. Israel has exclusively bombed Assad. They have not attacked any rebel groups. They're not rebels. They're mercenaries and they're terrorists.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a series of big can of worms, but that's how that starts. But Clean Break was basically laid out that plan on how you could foster these in-groups to fight each other, which is something the British had done in World War I, is to foster ethnic nationalism. Not nationalism based on an ideology of some cultural unity or something. That it's ethnic nationalism where you get identity politics. We're Kurdish. We're Sunni. You make them, you know, so attached to their religion or racial group or whatever.
Hey, Ryan, real quick. I learned from a Palestinian radio host on RBN. He did a podcast a while ago talking about Qatar and how the – America built one of the largest military bases in the world in Qatar, and then the sheikh or the prince, the guy running Qatar, actually founded and started Al Jazeera, which started the divide of Sunni and Shia and created that ethnic divide. So they controlled the media, controlled the divide between the different Islamic factions. So this whole Clean Break and Qatar having the military base built prior to 9/11, this was all planned, all ready to go.
Oh, well, I mean, Qatar and a lot of these Sykes-Picot nations are just little circles drawn around resources anyway. But Al Jazeera is filth. It's the left-wing imperialism is what I call it. So Al Jazeera English will do all these fluff pieces that are doing the same thing. They're trying to do the same thing that they do in the Middle East and the U.S., which is catering to identity politics. Is all like, you're not an American, you're a black American or a female American or a gay American or something, you know, fill in the hyphen. They do all these stories to that, all under the leftist banner of equality and this and that. But what they're really doing is getting you to obsess about biological categories. I was talking to a Russian guy last night, a journalist, and he was saying, you know, slavery was everywhere in the world, and it was Western civ that diminished it and got rid of it. But it seems like only America's obsessed with it like it happened yesterday. Like, there were slaves in Russia. There were slaves in Korea. There were slaves everywhere. Everyone got rid of slavery. But they don't talk about it now. It's like, yeah, we had slaves, we got rid of them. But in America, it's like this huge ordeal and part of history. They make sure that's beaten into your head.
Oh, yeah, Georgetown's talking about putting out reparations for previous slave owners that worked for the Georgetown University personnel and staff and ownership. $1 billion in reparations.
They're just – America is really obsessed with biological categories. They even invented a new one. Like, transgender is not a real thing. You either have a penis or a vagina, and your sex is not – it's not your sexual preference. It's not like your style, like whether you like football or Barbie or something. It's totally irrelevant. Like, any man can like that stuff, or woman can. It doesn't matter. It's not going to change your biological reality, you know. But they're like, but I identify as something. I'm like, fine, then you're whatever you are, and you identify as something, but it doesn't change it.
Well, that's
you
where know, we're going
sex
with
change.
Cultural Marx, yeah, cultural Marxism.
Cultural Marxism,
yeah. Yeah, that's where it comes from.
They can't really divide the U.S. religiously because people are – it's either Christian or atheist basically. And a lot of Protestant sects don't even know the difference between one another. If you asked a Baptist and a Methodist and a Presbyterian or whatever, what makes you that and not the other, they don't even know. Like, it's just Christian in the U.S. It doesn't – but race does work. In the Middle East, it's the opposite because they're almost – they're racially homogenous more than the U.S., but religiously, it's easy. But if you ask them, what is the great theological difference between a Sunni and a Shiite? It's petty, you know. It's like Gulliver's Travel. Do you have the egg on this side or this side kind of thing? But it's more of a – it's just a ethnic strife, you know. Everybody wants their own group because if the government engages in ethnic nepotism, you know, giving the jobs and stuff only to their own little tribe – then it is important to get your tribe in there. Otherwise, you're cut off. So it becomes important whether you're religious or not, because if someone else is nepotistic, then you have to be in order to fight that. So it's divide and conquer.
I would say that
purposely fostered.
Yeah, I would say that the Jewish people are probably the most tribal of them all throughout the world.
There's a lot of ethnic nepotism within Jewish culture. I mean, there are some Jews that are like, you know, I'm Jewish, but it's not like they're going to only exclusively hire other Jews or anything, but you see it in diaspora groups the most. Like, I don't think in Ireland people have to tell you they're Irish every day or whatever, whereas an Irish-American is very proud of that and would, like, mention it to you, or on St. Patrick's Day, going to go full out with the green and everything. But it's because in Ireland everyone's Irish, you don't have to, like, wear it on your chest, you know. But diaspora groups, like in the U.S., people are very proud of their Italianness or whateverness, you know, wherever their ancestors came from. Even they're totally American. Like, yeah. Like, you're not German. You don't speak German. You're not, like, you're American. Like, that's it. Like, maybe your granddad was or something, but so what? Like, but that's how it is. They're very proud of that because they don't really, there's no real American identity for a lot of them. They won't accept our folk anymore because it's been assaulted. The founding fathers are slave owners and so they're just these awful people. I'm like, that was everybody of that time period across the world, bud, you know? But
yeah, you know. Yeah. I would say cultural Marxism has crept into America to the point to where you can't even be proud of your heritage or the founding fathers, the founding of America. Even the education system shies away from having any pride in the creation of America and all the different things that we've accomplished here in America.
And it's been replaced by the opposite. It's become a contest of who's the biggest victim.
Correct. We'll be back on the other side.
Rose, and I took the Anti-Semitox Challenge. What's the anti-Cenotox challenge, you ask? Well, I had a problem. Everywhere I looked, I noticed that Jews were trying to make me gay and also that they control the banks and all of Hollywood. It was very upsetting. Then, I heard about anti-Cenotox, the cure for anti-Semitism. It gave me female pattern baldness, made my tits shrink, and I grew a beard, but it was worth it. Now, I'm a tranny and I don't complain about Jews at all. Thanks, Jews!
Welcome back, everybody, to Circus Maximus, and I have Ryan Dawson on the line with me. He has got the website ancreport.com. Please visit his website and do yourself a favor and check out his new film, The Empire Unmasked. It's completely worth it. It will definitely blow your mind when it comes to all of the different intrinsic value and all the detail related to 9/11 and there and even more than that related to a lot of different aspects of just the Israeli Empire, American CIA, FBI complicity, and even other intelligence agencies like the ISI. So I'd like to get more into the buildup of 9/11, Ryan, and kind of paint the picture for our audience and how that all transpired.
Well, part of the reason the movie's so long, I am covering like 9/11 and ISIS and a lot of big topics, but I wanted to show how it got going and what an intelligence agency even is, because a lot of countries didn't have them until after World War II.
Correct.
And we had the OSS morph into the CIA, people know, but prior to that, the State Department and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics were already doing a lot of the things the CIA now does. They were doing like controlled narco traffic and to create these black budgets, which they can use for black ops. And the CIA has overtaken the Federal Bureau of Narcotics completely now with the drug trade in Afghanistan and also in Vietnam. But that had been going on a long time with Central and South America pulling in drugs in through New Orleans and Miami and so on. And so that's nothing new, but people need to understand how these things get financed, because one reason people reject conspiracy theories about covert operations is like, oh, how could you get an entire Congress involved and no one – and they would appropriate this money for this stuff all in secret. Like, you don't. You don't need that at all. They have their own black budgets. You don't have to tell Congress. A few of them know, you know, because they're ideologically in line with it, but they keep it in the dark. And that's how Iran-Contra was. People were appalled. The difference is they got busted because a plane physically crashed with an Israeli pilot bound for Iran. And they had this big television trial. But Oliver North just got up there and was like, yeah, we did it. So that was his defense. He's like, but that's what we're doing, to fight the commies. And they wanted to create plausible deniability. So that way they could say Reagan and the Congress and all, they didn't know. But they didn't know because they didn't want to know. They're like, don't tell me that because then I'm responsible. You know, you guys just do what you're doing. So if you follow this group prior to the 80s even with Ted Shackley and these guys from the 60s and you see how they set up stations in Laos and Vietnam, and we're creating cargo companies, the TACA in Louisiana, but you had your own cargo companies in Laos that were taking opium and shipping it all over the world and taking these profits and hiding them in banks in Australia and all of this huge money laundering operation. None of it's secret, all of it admitted to now, you know. And that heroin racket just moved from the Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia area over to Afghanistan, and you can see how the CIA later is fostering and financing this Mujahideen in this sort of trifecta civil war in Afghanistan between the Northern Alliance and two Mujahideen groups, which is where you get Al-Qaeda. They weren't called Al-Qaeda at the time. Al-Qaeda just means the database. It's a list of foreign fighters. These diaspora groups that they were bringing into Afghanistan to fight the Soviets and also serve as cover for this entire opium war. And that's the excuse. The government will always look the other way because they say, well, look, we're using this for a covert ops against the commies. That was always the excuse. And when they're working with organized crime inside the United States, I'm talking about in the 30s and so on, like after the Banana Wars, after Kennedy's killed, and I'll skip all that, but they always could say, well, the profits of this are going to help KTM or something in China fight the communists, so look the other way. And that way the mob realized, well, as long as we make sure that our source of whatever narcotic is some anti-communist group in China, in Cuba, and whatever, the feds will leave us alone because they don't want to drag them to trial and hurt that because they understand that the sellers are using that money to buy and fight commies. So the mob realized this, and so you start seeing this relationship between organized crime and the CIA get tighter and tighter leading up to the assassination of the Kennedys. And these same guys go on after that all over the world, and they end up in Vietnam and Laos, like Shackley and his group. And you can see the DCI, the CIA, are over and over again controlling this large drug market. And organized crime in America was one thing. It's the same thing in other countries. You don't call them the mafia. You might call them warlords or cartels or whatever label. But the Mujahideen is, what are they? I mean, it's criminal. I mean, it's organized crime. You do it, it would be illegal otherwise to get a bunch of guns, kill people, and sell
freedom drugs. Fighters.
Yeah, they're freedom fighters. Exactly. They're freedom fighters. And then later on, they're terrorists, of course. But, I mean, today, we're financing Jandala and arming them. The Israelis are too. MEK is another one. Of course, in the past, the Mujahideen. Right now, you know, Ara al-Sham in Syria, which got a 9/11 plotter out of jail, Mohammed Zammar, who was the money man for Mohammed Atta, who was on Flight 11. He's like the ringleader of the hijackers. He got was out of jail in a prisoner swap in 2013 by these moderate rebels that were backing. In Libya, we backed Al-Qaeda, you know. The FSA is every bit as much of a terrorist group.
Yeah, there's photos of McCain with the Al-Qaeda during Libya.
Yeah, he's with al-Sham, and he was – I mean, he's many photos – with that. And Hillary, same, like she's, her emails are admitting, like, we're going to arm these groups because that's what Israel wants to weaken in Syria. Mm-hmm. And the surplus armaments that Gaddafi had go on the black market. Like, what happened to all of Libya's small arms?
They went to Syria.
some of them went to Syria and some of them went to Mali. And that Mali had this, a lot of security personnel and stuff too. They're just mercenaries. Gaddafi's not there to pay them. And ends up in Mali, and Mali has a war, and the French get involved there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, guns were run to Syria through Turkey and Jordan. But Obama also did this non-lethal aid package, and that's where they get all these Toyota Hilux trucks.
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds and hundreds of them, all the same model and year and new coats of paint and everything. And they just drove them down there from Turkey. But that was paid for by the United States as non-lethal aid to the moderate rebels, but of course it just goes to ISIS, you know. And they know that they're not that stupid. I mean, our own DIA admitted that. They said, we're going to foster a Salafist principality in Syria, and this is exactly what we want to oppose Assad.
Wasn't that what Michael Flynn said from the DIA?
Michael Flynn admitted that. He was the head of the DIA, so mm-hmm. he admitted that. But the DIA itself is saying this in their own papers, and then it's also in Hillary's emails that, you know, she leaked. She didn't leak. She purposely. I mean, Hillary Clinton, either, unless she is that stupid, which is possible. I don't think so, though. But she was just openly using a BlackBerry in places like China and stuff, and sending information about classified material to people, which anybody. I have friends even that could hack that and read everything, you know. But that's really a plausible deniability style way of selling information. It's like, well, I can't give it to you, but you can steal it, and I'll make it really easy to steal. Mm-hmm. And then they paid her through the Clinton Foundation with Frank Ustra, Wash's dirty money, and then donates it to the Clinton Foundation. So he has his organization in Canada. He's getting money from the Saudis, the Chinese, all these governments. And then he'll donate to the Clinton Foundation so that Clinton can write down we got X amount from Frank Ustra, and not saying Frank Ustra got X amount from all these different countries and mobster groups and stuff. So yeah, she didn't even do a good job of cleaning the money. Usually you have several mediums when you launder money and you want to wash money, but they know it doesn't really matter. Like, I could say all that and it's not going to be on TV, you know? Like, I could sit here and tell you every name and it wouldn't matter. And no one's going to kill me or anything either, because it doesn't matter. Like, you could tell Americans that nothing will happen. No one takes them to court. Nobody does anything.
I was going to say that's exactly what happened with a lot of these Israeli art students and urban moving systems, all these different Israelis that were arrested but then let go.
The Justice Department had to intervene there. The heads had to come in and actually protect them, because a lot of the lower FBI and the cops were really pissed about both the Dancing Israeli group, the moving system groups. There were five different moving companies that they know of. I don't know what's in the whited out part, but right, at least five. And then the art students were separate but not separate. It was they had different goals. But I mean, it's all Israel, so they're not separate in that sense.
So with these Israeli art students, you cover the angle of how they went to different DEA agents' private homes and scoping out and pretty much providing these artwork pieces, really crappy artwork, to where they were spying devices. What about these Israeli art students that people claim that were in the at the World Trade Center
Nonsense. The art students in the World Trade Center were from Vienna, not Israel, and they had nothing to do with 9/11. Some jackass made a film called Decade of Deception and released it on 9/11. My film is Decades of Deception. Right. And she's talking about Israel, this and that, and art students, and then she goes full on retard with other stuff in the film. And it just makes people throw the baby out with the bathwater. And when you Google Israeli art students now, it goes to that bullshit instead of cryptomy in a very concrete, very serious, you know, solid case of actual Israelis who claim to be from art schools, that some of which didn't even exist, who were spying on the DEA and military installations too. Mm-hmm. This Rebecca Roth, it's not even her real name, con artist, comes out with this film, and it's been seen by like a million people. Like, imagine if Empire Mask, War by Deception had that kind of push and distribution power. So you got to wonder about these things. Like, wait, this nobody who's never made anything before puts out this really crazy film on 9/11 and sort of says art student. And they're like, look, it says BA-8 on the box. That's weapons. I'm like, no, that's a postal code. Like, the stuff in it was so dumb. But the 9/11 kook movement, this is not a truth movement. The 9/11 kook movement will attach themselves to anything dumb. And that's what gets megaphoned, is all the silliness. If you say dustification or space rays or miniature nukes or a missile hit the Pentagon or any of the craziness, then that will get disseminated and distributed to millions, like, instantly. Alex Jones will have you on and all that. All the COINTELPRO will promote it. But if you say something serious, like cryptomy has or I have, about the actual Israelis and how, you know, Hanan Sarfati was pushing out 80,000, 100,000 a day in payments to these people, and how they're spying on the DEA. And you have the list of statements of what the DEA agents said and descriptions and names and people who got arrested. That you don't hear about because it's not in a, you know, slick film with scary music promoted by Jonestown. And so, whether he's COINTELPRO or not, it doesn't matter. The result's the same. Fetzer and all the weirdos, loose change, like all the idiots got promoted by Alex Jones.
Right.
And he's never talked about War by Deception and never will.
No, never really. You never hear any Israeli involvement from the Jonestown movement either.
You don't hear any Israeli involvement in the Iraq War either. I mean, that's even more clear because there's even more evidence, because it wasn't like a one-day event. This was a long process of propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
And you literally had an office within an office, the Office of Special Plans, run by these Israeli dual citizens, Douglas Fife and Pearl, these guys, Douglas Fife and Wolfowitz's sisters, Mark Zell, or it was dating Mark Zell, and Fife and Zell had a company together. I mean, he's an Israeli settler, but and so is Wolfowitz's sister. She lives in Hebron. Like, they're hardcore Zionists, and they're just pushing out all this BS, just bullshit. It's about yellow cake uranium. That was a Ladin lie. With Gert Bonifard, Michael Ladin.
Ryan, real quick, what I like about your research is you cover all the different power players, who benefits, all the different Israeli startups, and all the different angles to connect the dots without covering the aspect of how the towers fell so much. You don't go after that because that seems to be –
because it's a tar baby. Like, I could talk about the – I mean, basic 9/11 kook is like this. This is all they go on. Those buildings fell down too fast. I think there were bombs in there. We need to do more research. All I'm doing is asking questions. Building 7. That's it. Like, that's all they got. And I'm like, man, yeah, it does. You can look at that and go, yeah, it looked like a demolition. But that's not a very good argument. You can't be like, I think there were bombs because it looks like it was. And then, you know, splitting hairs about thermite and all that and jet fuel. I'm like, dude, actually, indoor fires do reach temperatures that can melt steel beams, even with no jet fuel at all. That is just a fact about fire. That doesn't mean it did, but it can. And when you make these giant exaggerations, you hurt yourself. If you go like the classic Alex Jones line about Building 7, only pockets of fire. Pockets of fire. It's like, no building ever fell from fire. It's one of their taglines. It's one of their conditioning, like brainwashing. Just say this line and you're gold. There were pockets of fire on the north side of the building at 9 in the morning. On the south side of the building at 5 in the afternoon, it was completely on fire with 6 stories missing on the southwest corner were completely gone. Like, you cannot omit that information, because if you act like it's only pockets of fire and then it falls symmetrically and it falls really fast and does definitely seem like demolition, you have to at least admit that there were big fires and that they let it burn for 7.5 hours straight without putting a hose on it or anything. Like, you have to say that. Because if you don't admit all of that, it looks like you're just lying and saying there was no fire when there was one, therefore fire took the building down. That's what a skeptic's going to think. So I'm like, please stop exaggerating. Like, just shut up, actually. Like, quit talking about the buildings falling down, which you don't really know. Like, architects of AE, whatever, the architects and engineers of 9/11 were saying a missile at the Pentagon. Richard Gage said that. He said he didn't talk about Israel because it was bad for the brand. I'm like, dude, it's not a mystery. Israelis got caught in a van full of RDX. Like, they had explosives. Like, there was a van with explosive devices found on 9/11, reported live. Like, the whole subway's full of smoke. The first floor was blown out before the towers fell down. There's your evidence of bombs, and, you know, in the parking garages and in the basement, if you want to, if that's your only point. Not thermite, not how fast the building fell. It's like there were literally vans full of explosives that were busted by not just foreigners, foreign intelligence assets. Like, but no, they don't go on about that. They're just, well, I found nanothermite. I'm like, of course you do. It's just oxidized aluminum and iron with rut. Like, that's when you melt an aluminum plane plus all the piping and all the aluminum in the building, it's going, of course it's, you're going to find that nano levels. That's like being shocked you found concrete next to broken glass. Like, duh. It doesn't mean anything. And I'm like, if it does mean something, I'll leave the same thing Chomsky said. Go to a university with your engineering credentials and your anomalies and stuff and present your case and have it out in the court system. Of course, they don't do that because they don't actually have anything.
So you cover the different moving systems, not just urban moving systems, but there were several different moving truck companies that were all tied into the 9/11 attacks that were all
right, and white glove movers and classic international movers are maybe more important than urban moving systems. And urban moving systems also had two names. They had, it was max movers when they're doing long distance and urban moving when they're doing short distance. And that's important because you're going to find urban moving systems as far away as Pennsylvania and Ohio. It should have been max movers, but they had a, they were in a hurry when flight 93 was taken down by the passengers, and yes, it really was. That, you know, somewhat they had to go do cleanup, and that's another story. But for, I got to tell people, how do we know there were 5 moving companies if only Urban Moving Systems was arrested? And that's because these idiots had a notebook in the car with phone numbers to all these other moving companies. And that's what they were doing, is they had, after Doric Towers, where three of them were witness dancing. And it's not, I gotta say this too. Maria, the witness with binoculars that ended up calling the police, was not the first witness. Mm. There were witnesses prior to that, which is in the FBI documents, which I show in Empire Mass. I physically show you the FBI saying, yeah, we have witnesses at 8 o'clock. And even if eyewitness is off, maybe it was 8:15 or something, it's definitely before a plane hit the building, because someone's definitely going to remember what happened before that and after that, right? So after Doric Towers, they drove over to White Glove Movers, which is not that far from Urban. It's even closer to Doric. And they're celebrating with each other. A girl who worked at White Glove was the roommate of the Sivan Kersberg in Brooklyn. So she was there, and they extensively questioned her too. All I know is her N is the last letter of her first name, because they whited it out, but they made a mistake. And there's also a flyer that says Karen's birthday bash. So this is a possibility. But anyway, they had this notebook with the phone numbers in it. So the cops and then later the FBI of the Newark division go and trace these numbers. And they're all numbers to moving companies. Why does a moving company have other moving companies there that are all run by Israelis? Mm-hmm. And then they find out, okay, the brothers, Paul Kersberg and Sivan Kersberg, were already flagged on the counterintelligence database. They already knew about these guys. Paul Kersberg ends up admitting he worked for the Jewish agency. That's who sent him there. Jewish agency, by the way, is Board of Governors, is Erich Wertheimer, who's the one who bribed the police commissioner, Bernard Carrick, $250,000. And then they also laundered money through the Gambino family to Carrick. He ended up going to jail for this. Like, the police commissioner in New York went to jail. Like, and that the 9/11 kook movement doesn't talk about this. They can't. They're just like, boom, something fell too fast. I just want to shoot these people. I'm like, God damn it, you don't know anything about 9/11. Just get out of the way. I got this. Just let me handle it.
Hey, Ryan, you also mentioned in the film how Carrick was visiting Israel prior to 9/11 as well.
Yeah, just weeks prior. He was there August 26th to 29th. I mean, just long enough to go get his money, basically, mm-hmm. kiss the Wailing Wall and all that. And, you know, Giuliani defers to him. He's the one that tries to cover up the George Washington Bridge fiasco. And people have said to me, I think that was just confusion. It was the same van as the dancing Israeli van. And I go, all right, you can say that. But you've got live reports at night, you know, of that arrest. And the Israelis are arrested at 3 in the afternoon. Plus, you've got three guys arrested at night and five earlier in the afternoon. You definitely know how many people were in the van. Like, you have to – they're two different vans. But anyway, Classic International Movers, which is one of the five listed, is flagged by the Miami field office. So the FBI in Miami are saying, hey, by the way, these field office reports, this is the exact same criteria used for the 28 pages with Osama Basnan and Omar Bayoumi and how they were financing Al-Midhar and Al-Hazmi in California, like all that damning information about the Saudis who were getting money from Prince bin Turk Fasil and his wife and Vandar Bush, and like all that is just based on FBI field office reports from Phoenix and Denver and areas out west. The same criteria I'm using right now is from field office reports. And the Miami division is contacting Jersey and New York and saying, hey, Classic International Movers, you know, one of the 9/11 hijackers, which I found out by deduction was Al Omari, who's in the photos with Muhammad Atta in Maine and on the ATM, that guy. He actually used Classic International Movers to move from New Jersey down to Florida. And the Miami field office had gotten wind of this serendipitously by following the art students. Because Yaron Schmel was both. He was one of the dancing Israelis, and he'd also lived in Fort Lauderdale. Idiot still had his driver's license with the address and everything. And his address made it that he was a roommate of art students. So, like, he's living with art students. So he was part of that, too. And he moves at the same time they do. And so, anyway, a 9/11 hijacker is using an Israeli front company to move from Jersey to Florida. You cannot say they didn't have foreknowledge. No, they definitely did. And they're filming the first plane hitting, and they're celebrating. And then they say, well, everyone thought it was just an accident. I'm like, no, everyone didn't, because your brother and two of your buddies are up there celebrating and dancing between the hits. Like, the first plane hits, and they're all flicking lighters and everything. Then the second plane hits. Why would you celebrate a horrible plane crash because they knew what it really was. And Sivan Kersberg, if that's not enough evidence, if the witnesses, you know, at 8 o'clock seeing their van there, if that's not enough, Sivan Kersberg was witnessed there the day before and 3 days before because he was there on September 10th and on the 8th and possibly on the 7th. He was in the elevator. He lied and said he was a construction worker. It just wasn't true. So and in their van, they've got maps highlighted with Doric Towers and the World Trade Center highlighted, like, here's where it'll be, and here's a place to view it across the river. Like, why were they highlighting Doric Towers if they just heard it on the news and drove there really quickly? Like, that's their excuse, right? By the way, all five of them lie about their timelines, about where they were and everything, all different stories from each other. All of them have passports to leave the country immediately. And the only one that really tells the truth is Mamari. And the only reason he was part of that group is because Sivanen recognized him for military service in Israel. And he'd only been in the country a couple weeks, so he got caught up with these guys. He's asleep in the van. They pick him up, a white glove or whatever, and on the way back. And he did lie and failed his polygraph test, but on the second run, he starts telling the truth. And boy, it gets really damning. And I just encourage people to watch Empire Unmasked to hear about what he said, because I just don't feel like talking for hours straight, you know, but it's all in there. And I'm also probably on 9/11 this year, I'm going to release some information, a clip from Empire Unmasked on the anniversary, just to say, look, if you're really serious about 9/11 and you want names and details about foreknowledge and how hijackers got financed and Kofor Black and Richard Blee and Tenet and guys in the CIA who are well aware of this and planning this and all that, and spell it out. And not only that, just go roll right into the anthrax BS and how that got attached to Iraq. It's all in the Empire Unmasked. It's a long film, but I'll tell you what, it would take your whole life to find all this information on your own. So 5 hours, 4 hours and 54 minutes, really not that bad. And you don't have to watch it in one sitting, but you can skip to the 9/11 stuff if you want to. But I feel like it's important to get your head around how these things get financed, because if you're going to make the argument to someone that rejects all that, you're going to have to baby step them and say, well, was Iran Contra a covert operation? Yes, definitely was. Did that not involve multiple countries about $1 billion? Yes, it did. Did they not kill 30,000 people? Yes, they did. You got to walk through that. You can't just start with 9/11. You got to explain the Safari Club.
All right, we'll be right back. We carried on through drought and flood. Built this land upon our graves. As fortune favors just the brave. Don't worry, child. Don't you fear at all. Don't worry, child.
Are you constantly thinking naughty, hateful thoughts about the Jews? Do you find yourself actually wishing the gas chambers were real? Do you hate the sight of a yarmulke because it reminds you of the parasitic race that has their greedy little hands in just about everything? Well, then we have got something for you. Ask your doctor about Anti-Semitox. Anti-Semitox is a long-acting injectable lobotomy that assures you will never think those anti-Semitic thoughts ever again. May cause suicide, depersonalization, thoughts of ripping off your skin, your dick may fall off, and you may become infertile. I made the switch to Anti-Semitox. Now I don't even care if I'm a goyim slave. Thanks, Jews!
Thank you.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Circus Maximus. I'm your host, Nick, and I have Ryan Dawson on the line with me, and we are discussing his documentary film, The Empire Unmasked, and different aspects of 9/11 for the 15th anniversary. And Ryan, a lot of people in the 9/11 research community bring up the Carl Cameron Fox News report involving a lot of the different Mossad agents that were arrested, and well, they didn't really say Mossad per se, but they said Israeli members of intelligence and things of that nature. What is your thoughts on how that got presented and why it was presented in the first place?
It wasn't actually. They never aired it. They had a four-part series, and it was only on their website briefly, and then even that got removed. Mm-hmm. And they rounded up 160 of them, and then they rounded up another 40 more. So you got 200 of these Israeli spies, and it was not just physical spies either. It was came back in InfoSeek, where their in InfoSeek, which was like a way of hacking information through your telephone, mm-hmm. and through your computers, where they could spy on and eavesdrop and listen in. And I even found that on my computer.
Oh wow!
Like, why am I being spied on in Japan too? They were listening in. And I'm like, whatever. I say everything publicly anyway, so it didn't bother me that much. Just like, well, at least I know I'm on the right track.
So is it a piece of hardware or it's a software that's installed into the...
This is an area where I'm ignorant because I don't understand computer stuff. I think it's software. But okay. They have some nerdy way of spying on you. They described it as like a backdoor channel because they're setting up the security for a lot of places, mm-hmm. but they leave a little like special key for themselves, like where they can go in and look at everything whenever they want, right? And these companies are 50% owned by the Israeli government. And so I was digging into this and found out, like, separate from 9/11, a lot of this Deborah Jean Palfrey stuff, this DC Madam and the hookers they were providing to our Congress critters, the Israelis knew all of it. And this total data mining thing, it's got a bunch of nicknames, but Richard Perle was threatening people with it all the time, slyly. And so it's a way of gathering blackmail, and it's a way of gathering information, and they actually sell the blackmail. So they definitely knew, and it was weird because whenever the FBI was looking at 9/11 suspects, or on Israeli art students, they suddenly would change their behavior. It's like once they made a call or talked about it, they knew they were always staying two steps ahead of them. Mm. So they're actually shielding their own agents by spying on the phone and computer systems of those trying to pursue them, right, of all the different, you know, letter networks, even local cops. But a lot of them screwed up anyway because these morons that would go to sell art, they would say, all right, well, let me have a contact in case I want to buy some art. And they're like, oh, well, I'm not selling art. I'm just showing it to promote a show later. We're going to have an art show, so mm-hmm. I can't really sell you this or give you this right now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, the DEA was aware of it and basically was told to shut up. I mean, but, you know, got Chertoff in there. He ends up becoming the new head of the Department of Homeland Security later, too. but he was in the Justice Department first. And, of course, Mark Grossman was totally involved in 9/11. Sybil Edmonds witnessed him meeting with Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, and they're talking about FBI suspects, 9/11 suspects, and this is prior to 9/11 happening. Even they say, we better get them out of the country before they spill the beans. Like, get them out of jail. Spill the beans on what? You know? But Mark Grossman, you know, he's a tribesman. He's part of this, and he's a part, he's in the State Department, and they had enough guys in bottleneck positions. You got Perle and all these guys in the Defense Department, Grossman in the State Department, Chertoff in the Department of Justice, and they're working with their American counterparts, and this was a jointly conducted covert operation, just like Iran-Contra. In Iran-Contra, with the U.S. and Israel working together, it was similar to the Soviet-Afghan war, where the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are jointly, covertly working together to finance these foreign fighters. And so I want to point out to people, like, it's not something they had to put together. There was a group called the Safari Club set up in 1976 when the CIA was getting gutted and you had Watergate in 73 and they really have the microscope on them. They moved everything offshore. Peter Dale Scott calls it a CIA within the CIA. And Shackley and all these guys, Maurice Bishop, all these people that were involved in the Kennedy assassination, they just go abroad and they continue the same operations. They become station chief of fill in the blank. And Riyadh becomes the new capital, not Langley. And so, for example, it's Saudi Arabia's royal family that morphs BCCI Bank in Pakistan into this giant network of banks to launder money. Previously to that, they'd used Riggs Bank of the United States. During the whole Mujahideen operation, they used BCCI, where that's how they paid Al-Qaeda. That's how bin Laden got his money, was through these banks. And that was set up by this group called the Safari Club, where the Israelis and the U.S. already had an access. They brought Saudi Arabia in. This is after Yom Kippur. They knew they have to incorporate the Saudis because of the gas shortage in the 70s and OPEC and the weapons. So they're like, we're going to buy them off. So they let the Saudis in. They bring them in. George Bush Sr., who becomes the DCI of the CIA, already has relationship, business relationships with the Saudis and with Prince bin Turk Fasil and with Bandar Bush. I mean, he's nicknamed Bandar Bush. They already have these oil operations. He's going. He's got good relations. So he brings them in. They set up these money laundering operations through these banks, and they start paying foreign fighters, just like the CIA had done with Riggs Bank in the past, just like the CIA had done when they were messing with Honduras and paying all these mercenary groups all throughout Central America. They do the same thing in the Middle East and Asia. Same thing. So in Afghanistan, they're doing that. Now, it's important because that bank – falls apart in the 90s, they got busted, and the CIA went right back to Riggs. But it's the same players, because when you look through, like, at the damning 28, the royal family is sending money through intermediaries to 9/11 hijackers, and they used Riggs Bank. And that's what, when Osama Basnan and Omar Bayoumi, through their wives, are giving money to two of the West Coast hijackers, they are writing checks through Riggs. Riggs is the traditional CIA bank. Riggs is who set up the Federal Reserve. Like, everyone knows the half that story on Jekyll Island with Aldrich and how they set that up and create the Federal Reserve. But, you know, that was just copying central banks in Europe that had already existed. But they didn't write that down and develop that in Georgia. The Riggs Bank's pigeons are the ones that gave them that, and they needed senators to make it happen. You know, so they officially created it through Congress after the Jekyll Island meetings, but they didn't develop that. That was the Riggs boys. And the Riggs guys are used again during 9/11. And nothing happens to this bank. BCCI got dismantled, but the damage is already done. But it's just their same partners in crime, the Saudis, who they'd used in the 80s to finance bin Laden, are still financing Al-Qaeda through CIA banks openly. And these guys, the case in California is so bad because Al-Mihdhar and Al-Hazmi were already flagged for the USS Cole bombing and should have been on the no-fly list from the State Department, et cetera. And yet they fly in with their own passports, with their real names. Bayoumi bought them an apartment and lived with them for their first month. He moves them down to San Diego, and they're – oh, well, Culver City is really L.A., but – they're living next door to them. It's impossible they didn't know, you know. And then when the FBI is looking at it, the CIA refused to share information. The CIA had followed these guys to an Al-Qaeda summit meeting in Malaysia. And then we know from Private Manning that not only were they at this meeting, but at the meeting they had met with a colleague, Sheikh Mohammed, who's definitely on like Interpol's most wanted list and a criminal unknown. They knew that. And then they watched him fly and go live in California. They know that they're meeting with Al-Qaeda. They're meeting with colleague Sheikh Mohammed. He's like top 10 worst terrorists in the world, according to the U.S. And then they're living in California, and no one arrests them or spies on them or anything. They refused to share this information with the FBI. The CIA counterintelligence knew this the whole time and said nothing. They didn't say anything. And the Saudis are living with them. So both the CIA and the Saudis knew these guys had met with Al-Qaeda and are going to flight schools and are living in California. And then you could have watched them meet with Hadi Hanjour and all that. You could have followed them and busted the whole thing. They meet with Al-Shehi later. Al-Shehi's getting financed through the United Arab Emirates through this stupid honey jarring company. They tried to say that's where the money came from. I mean, he got sent his own money, but the go-between, he got thrown in Gitmo. But none of these other players, Miami's walking around free right now. Like all the Saudi and Americans involved, nothing happens.
It
and
sounds
you have
like
CIA whistleblowers, but who in the media is going to explain any of this? Nobody.
Of course not. Now it sounds like you're covering some of what Able Danger was all about with John O'Neill.
A little bit. I mean, they were following Mohammed Atta, which is, I mean, it's a similar story, but they, I mean, the Israelis and the Moroccans and the Americans knew about Mohammed Atta in Germany. They had their phones bugged. They knew their apartment, and he's living with two other hijackers. I want to point out Ziad Al-Jarrah did not live with them. He lived separate from them the whole time. This guy ends up with two first cousins in Israeli espionage. Shortly after 9/11, Ali Al-Jarrah and Yusuf Al-Jarrah busted as spies who were spying on Hezbollah. So you got a 9/11 hijacker with two first cousins who are not only Israeli, they're not Israeli, they're Arabs, but they're working for Israeli intelligence. I mean, amazing. And this isn't like their cousins, like Alex Jones says Bush and Obama are cousins, like 33rd degree cousins. Who's not 33rd degree cousins? It's meaningless. They're not all one family or anything like that. It's all bullshit. This is their first cousins. I mean, their uncle was a politician in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. But you can't get to that point. And the only evidence that Ziad is on this Flight 93 is they found his unburned passport. That's not impossible, but it's highly implausible. But how come he's not mentioned by any of the calls from the air phones? They mentioned three hijackers instead of four. And he's not even mentioned by the other hijackers. And when they're screaming at the pilot, they're screaming another guy's name. And Ziad's supposed to be the pilot, but this guy, Saeed, is who they're all talking about. And that's in the transcripts. It's in the Massawi trial. It's available. You can read it. They also had knives, not box cutters, which is supported by the physical evidence, you know, of itemized listed of what they found on Flight 93 crash site. And no, it was not just a hole. They found 90% of that plane was still there. Like, but the 9/11 kook movement, what they do is they obfuscate all that by saying cell phones don't work on planes. It's an air phone, not a cell phone. That takes 2 seconds to debunk. But if you say that cell phones didn't work on planes and you stop the story there, then you don't add up like, oh, how come all the callers are talking about three guys instead of four? And how come this fourth guy who's never mentioned, it turns out, has two first cousins in Israeli espionage? What a coinkydink. But you can't get to that point in the story because the kooks just bullhorn so loud. That plane was shot down by a missile and phones don't work and blah, blah, blah. And it's just a big tar baby, and you can't argue with these people because it's just a dogmatic religion for them because they heard their talking points from Alex Fucktard Jones Melonhead over there, and he's done so much damage. Like, they're like, oh, the hijacker's still alive. There were no hijackers. This is all remote control. Like, there were hijackers, and if you follow these assholes, you see how they're getting financed by foreign intelligence agencies with the green light from the CIA. And this is how it was in prior operations, which have already been proven. It's nothing new. And the same shit we're doing with ISIS. Like, if you know what happened before 9/11 and after 9/11, And you look at especially the anthrax case, which you probably won't have time to go into today, but it's really clear. They recycle the same strategy over and over again. But when it, I think with Iraq, you can kind of explain the Office of Special Plans, and a lot of Americans know that that was deception, not mistakes. I think they get it. The Niger forgery is the most clear case, you know, clear-cut example of that. But when it gets to 9/11, there's such a cloud of stupid around it that even people who don't believe the official story do not want to publicly admit that or show that because they don't want to be associated with people talking about space aliens and missiles and stuff. And I don't blame them. Like, I constantly have to do this huge disclaimer. I say I'm a 9/11 researcher. I'm like, no, I don't think a missile hit the Pentagon. Yes, I know there's plane debris in a big hole. Yes, I know that I'm not one of these people. I have a very solid theory that you're willing, you know, question it. I've got FBI documents. I have everything proven, really. But the problem is not combating the official story. The problem is the 9/11 kook movement. That's what's in the way. It's Alex Jones. That guy's the problem. He gives the kosher version of 9/11. I'm like, well, 9/11 wasn't kosher. So if you're gonna find, if you really want to know the truth, you cannot omit the Israeli role. You just can't.
So with the John O'Neill story, I actually saw that documentary quite a few times. I thought it was pretty good, tying a lot of the different financial aspects, the different companies that benefited.
They killed him. I mean, yeah, they went over like Kroll and a lot of the reinsurance companies and stuff. It's AIG. Very interesting. And you know, these things get physically destroyed in the towers. Like the plane actually hit on the floors between Fitzgerald and Kroll. Like that's very interesting. And he was killed, and he was yanked off the case. And you know, when Schaefer wrote a book about Able Danger called Operation Darkheart, the Pentagon bought it up and burned it, and then he had to reissue a more redacted version. Like, they bought up the book and burned it. They're physically burning the book. What are they scared of? But if you trace back these hijackers and you see where they're training and you know we know about them, I mean, either you have to admit complicity or an extreme level of incompetence. But when you really put it all together, it's not incompetence. This was intentional, just like the Iraq War. They did not believe there were weapons of mass destruction. They knew there weren't any. They just lied. They knew that was bogus. They're rehashing lies from the 90s. They're forging documents about yellow cake uranium. They're making a story out of nothing about aluminum tubes. This wasn't incompetence. It was malevolence. And 9/11 was malevolence. It was not incompetence. The CIA knew. And if it was incompetence, if they're that goddamn stupid, then they're useless. I mean, they shouldn't get a dime. They should get rid of them.
Right. And that whole blowback theory just goes out the water also then.
Right. It's backtrack. It's not blowback. Mm-hmm. Like, it's intended consequences.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
There is some blowback, inevitably. Like, they can't predict everything. Like, sometimes they just, oh, that was worse than we thought it was going to be. But they don't care. I mean, their whole idea is, whack the hornet's nest and see what happens. Like, as long as they can get these factions fighting each other, great. You know, they're not going to predict every little thing, but they can predict, you know, chaos, and that's all they wanted.
Right, and that's the force multiplier, right, that concept?
Yeah, well, force multipliers are also used as a term for springboarding media, where you have a slogan or something, just like Alex does with Pockets of Fire and No Building Ever Fell from Fire. You get these slogans like, get them over there before they get us over here.
Mm.
Mushroom cloud. Can't let smoke gun be a mushroom cloud.
Mimic warfare. Yeah, mimic warfare.
Right. Too big to fail. Well, we had to do something. They're too big to fail. You say it over and over again, and you have all your talking heads say the same stuff. They do this even about petty things. There's a great video about like the Easter Bunny or something, and they get all these news channels reading this verbatim little talking point about the Easter Bunny, the exact phrases and everything, and you realize the press, they're not really reporting news like they went and did an investigation. They're just reading a script that was given to them. That's all. And they screwed up bad with Building 7 jumping the gun and saying it fell down before it fell down on CNN and BBC and on
Well, what do you make of that screw up? It seemed as if the intention was to bring that building down.
Well, they screwed up before that. They screwed up at 10:45 in the morning. They said it fell down. And then again, they said around 5 o'clock, and then it was about 22 minutes later where it actually fell. So they had jumped the gun twice on the same building that day. But it's just sort of lost in the chaos of the news, and they go, oh, well, I mean, your excuse would be, well, it was going to fall. So it seemed like it's imminent, like it's definitely going to fall soon. It's missing a corner, pieces are falling off, whatever. So we think that building's gone. And then someone takes that to be like, oh, it's literally already fallen. That could be your excuse. Like, you can always have an ad hoc hypothesis and explain something away, and maybe that's actually true. Maybe they just said it seems like it's going to fall, and someone said it's fallen and made that mistake. And then the news companies all copy each other. CNN said it fell, so we're going to say it fell, and that kind of crap can happen. But it's like, you can excuse like one thing like that, but when you add it all together, you're going to have to make up a lot of those kinds of excuses. But the media does screw things up a lot, but that is not like the crux of Building 7. That's like one piece of information, but you got asymmetric fire and asymmetric collapse. You got, you know, 93 never found its target because it went down in Pennsylvania. It was going back to New York. So immediately they all said it was going to the White House. I'm like, but they said they're going back to New York, like on the plane where they left from. It headed that way, not that way. So, but anyway, and if it had hit, it would have hit about 1043, 1045. Which is exactly when they said a 50-story building had just fallen down the first time, right? So the time stamps line up. Now, that's all circumstantial. And I mentioned all that, I think, in War by Deception and Empire Mass, both. But I don't dwell on it because all that stuff's like, it's neat, it's worth saying, but I don't like the circumstantial as much as the concrete.
Right.
You know, Zier Forgeries is concrete. That is, person is not even in power. He could not have signed his name. Someone else did. That can't be a mistake. That has to be intentional. Those kind of things are what I like to really get my calls into. And then, yeah, if someone was going to ask me to speculate on 9/11, I could make another five-hour movie of all the circumstantial stuff that sort of aligns. But I don't want to – but, you know, I'll definitely make a mistake if I do that. Circumstantial evidence is not useless. It's not. It's definitely worth looking at. But concrete evidence is better, and I try to stick there as a journalist. You know, yeah. I'm not supposed to speculate.
Now in
a radio show, I can.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Now, in your film, you cover some of the different, not testimonies, but live shots of the fire departments, the first responders talking about explosions, even the media talking about explosions in the building. What do you make of that? Does that fit into a controlled demolition concept to you?
I mean, it can when you add them all together, but to me what's more interesting is police finding a van with a suspicious device, an explosive device inside. So that's how the 93 attack was. They parked a Ryder truck in the parking garage under the building and were going to blow up the columns. And you see this shake before it comes down. But again, like the physical collapse part, it's kind of like if your audience isn't physicists and engineers and stuff, mm-hmm. It's easy for anyone to lie about that kind of stuff, but these eyewitnesses did not make that up. Like, they did hear explosions. The firemen were like, that was the third explosion. Like, something was shaking the building to get the top to fall. You know, like, it's burning for an hour. Let's do it, guys. You know, there's squibs popping out. The basement's full of smoke. The subway's full of smoke. But the most damning info for me isn't that people running out of the building heard an explosion. Well, maybe something else blew up in the building. There's lots of stuff in there. You can always find some excuse, right?
Sure.
But maybe the car in the parking garage got overheated and blew up, so that blew up the car next to it. So you're going to hear this boom, boom, boom below. Fine. But, okay, but how does the lobby have panels fall off when the window's broken and everything before the collapse? It's not like the plane hit it so hard it shook the building and broke the glass. You know, how do you have fire in the basement before it falls? Once it falls, sure, everything is on fire, got it. But something hitting approximately 94 floors above should not set the basement on fire and fill the entire subway with smoke, which is reported live. The entire, like, that's a lot of people. I was in the subway, and it's full of smoke. It looked like a bomb had gone off. Where is that smoke coming from? You know, the smoke up above is visibly flying, you know, in the wind, upwards and away. So the subway should not have been full of smoke.
Right.
And they're saying basically as the plane hit or shortly before it hit above, something went off below to start breaking the foundation.
I think it was Sophia Smallstorm that did a documentary where she actually added sound effects for the explosions that weren't in the original footage. Did you hear that before?
No, I haven't. I don't like faking stuff, though, because even if those, they should have been there and they've been removed, like guessing or that kind of, I don't, you should never exaggerate when you got a real case, because if you make one exaggeration and someone figures that out, they'll throw away everything.
Right.
Even though you're like certain, like, well, that had to make a sound if there's a flash, like, but you can't do that stuff. Just stick with the concrete. That's my way. I mean, she can do whatever she wants, but.
Yeah, it was an early film, too. It was one of the first 9/11 films that came out, from what I understand. At least that's what she claims, anyway.
But again, it's like you don't really have to speculate, because you have people of a foreign intelligence agency busted filming the attack with total prior knowledge, spying on the DEA, all this long story, and the same cabal is lying about Iraq, associating Iraq to 9/11 by saying Mohammed Atta got anthrax in Prague from Iraqi officials, which is coming from James Woolsey, and Israeli security forces witnessing the transfer. And then that goes out on the 27th and 28th in the London Times and all these newspapers saying, hey, Blit had it first, Le Monde from France. They're all saying Mohammed Atta got anthrax from Iraqis in Prague based on Israeli intelligence.
Right.
Well, they did not witness such a transfer because Mohammed Atta was not in Prague meeting anybody, neither were Iraqi officials. And guess what? Iraq didn't have anthrax and neither did Al-Qaeda. But when even the official story, they blamed it on Bruce Ivins. We're like, well, if Bruce, and he didn't do it, but if Bruce Ivins sent the anthrax, how did the Israelis witness the Iraqis giving it to Mohammed Atta? Like, they obviously didn't. And then on the notes, it says, death to America, death to Israel. You know, P.S., we're evil Muslims. Allah is great. And it's, they misspelled penicillin the same way they did in the 1997 letter to B'nai B'rith, which they blamed on Holocaust deniers. Like, it's so over the top. And they spelled anthrax with a CK instead of an X. Like, look, we'll make misspellings because they're all dumb animals. Or that's how they think of these people.
Right.
And it's like, you wrote that yourself, clearly. You know, you've got Zionists caught in 92 stealing anthrax from Fort Detrick, Maryland, and trying to get this guy, Ayad Assad, fired. The reverse happens. Philip Zack writes a letter prior to any anthrax being opened saying, I think this guy Assad sent an anthrax. It's like, oh, really? You just guessed that an anthrax attack was happening because he assumed the letters would have been open, but because all the planes got grounded after 9/11, the mail wasn't delivered, and then blah, blah, blah. So the anthrax letter to Brokaw and stuff gets opened after. I got a poster here for you. Actually, this is video, right? Afterwards. I make this. This is what I do. This is what a dork I am. I have a big timeline of all the anthrax stuff.
Yeah, you used part of that in your documentary as well.
I did, but this one's better. and, you know, who's – that's upside down for you. Who's lying about it, you know? Sapphire, Epstein. You got a certain theme here about who's lying about anthrax. It supposedly says death to Israel. And these are the people writing about it and jumping the gun and talking about it. And they've got the same misspellings and stuff on prior hoax letters. And it's amazing. It's like, oh, you sent anthrax so lethal to Patrick Leahy that it would kill you. And, I mean, it's got accelerants on it and everything. But you're going to send hoax anthrax to Judith Miller, mm-hmm. you know, supposedly from Iraq, when she's the biggest warmonger against Iraq ever. Mm-hmm. And you're going to send her fake anthrax. And you're going to send fake. You're going to send the real and most deadly anthrax to Patrick Leahy and Daschle. You know, Leahy, the Leahy Amendment, which would forbid aid to Israel. Leahy, who is opposing this fast-tracking of the Patriot Act. Those are the guys you're trying to kill. And you're going to send fake anthrax to Fox News and Judith Miller with the identical notes proving that it's from the same people and not a copycat That's attack. Good. Like, it's obvious you sent this.
When all music to play
Wow. Hi, my name's Shield Maiden. I'd like to talk to you about a serious problem plaguing the world today. It was something that I suffered from for years. I used to fantasize about shoving Jews back in the oven. I had dreams of creating lampshades, and for months I fought the urge to surround every Jewish name I saw with parentheses. But thanks to Anti-Semitox, I am now a happy little goyim slave again. Anti-Semitox helped me realize that Jews really are the chosen ones, and not the money-hungry evil parasites I thought they were. Stop being a free thinker and become another sheeple. Try Anti-Semitox today. Their white genocide agenda depends on it.
Welcome back, everybody, for the last half hour of Circus Maximus with a special edition with Ryan Dawson for the 15th anniversary of 9/11. Hey, Ryan, real quick, what do you make of the Larry Silverstein pullet multiple times of saying that? That means nothing?
Pullet, really, he said in the sentence after we decided to pull out because there have been so much loss of life that we decided to pull out of the building. You know, if you're going to demolish Building 7, you can't just, while the fire is small, just blow it up because everyone say, wait, why did that fall down, right? So you're going to have to let the fire get at least big enough to be plausible enough to blame it on the fire, right? So what he said was a lot of fire, and he's right, I mean, in a way, a lot of firemen had died in World Trade Center 1 and 2 trying to put out the fire. So a lot of firemen had already died, and he didn't want to risk losing any more people, and he's like, it's already had a building fall on top of it. It's gone. Just let it burn. So they pulled off and they watched it burn. And they were waiting for that building to fall down. That's his excuse. Now, I don't think he should be able to get insurance on it if he purposely let it burn, but he did.
That was what, Judge Michael McKaysey that made that happen?
Was it or Frank Lowry, maybe?
They were business partners, I thought, in that.
You know, I forget, actually, people can look it up, but yeah. Pullet, they're like, you know, for Jones to be like, pullet, that's an industry term for demolition. I'm like, dude, yeah, you can pull things down. You use the word pull, like pull it, like, you know, with a crane, like pull the piece down or something. But he is saying, and he explained, like in the same, you know, time where he's in the interview where he says pull it, he says, there was already so much loss of life, so we decided to just pull it. Like, it means, like, pull out of the operation. Like, that's it. He's not so stupid to say, like, oh, so we decided to demolish it. Like, come on. This is a billionaire.
All right,
he was going to let it burn. That's it. And so it's like, fine.
Hey, we got a caller, 773. What would you like to add, caller, and what's your name?
Yeah, hi. This is Ed from Chicago.
Hey, Ed, what's going on, man?
Hi, Nick, and appreciate your guest, very knowledgeable, Ryan.
Ryan Dawson.
I've been in concrete all my life, and high-rise. I worked downtown Chicago. I know a ton of air workers and all that. What are you saying brought the buildings down then? I mean, is that not important?
I think it was demolished. I just think the arguments for it are really bad. Like, there are better arguments to show that there are bombs in the building and things like that. Like I've seen the whole subway full of smoke and, you know, live reports of bombs, police actually finding an explosive in a van. You can't get more damning than that. But just saying, like, if fell at freefall speed and this, or, you know, jet fuel can't do this and that or whatever, or no building ever fell from fire, like no building was also hit by a 767 airplane either, and do not say there, you know, the Empire State Building was hit by a, of a little bomber because it's got like 40 times less gas and it's not even remotely in the same league as a plane. Like, when people make stupid arguments, you have a good argument about bombs, but Alex Jones's little taglines are all terrible. And the saying shit like a cell phone doesn't work on a plane is a really bad argument when they're just using the air phone. Like, that's it. It's the end of that. Saying a missile hit the Pentagon and showing only the hole in the second floor, not this 90-foot hole in the first floor, not to mention there's debris of a plane everywhere. They make these strawman arguments, like saying, well, a plane, you can't just evaporate. I'm like, I agree. And it didn't. There's pieces of it all over the place. Like, you can look up Google Pentagon debris, see the plane and even passengers. They had DNA evidence of all the victims. Like, it's at the Walter Reed Medical Center. Like, so you cannot get all this stuff. So what I'm saying is, I'm not saying that fire took the buildings down. I'm saying fire is the cover. But you got to have to at least, you can't just blow it up at 9 in the morning and say, aha. You have to let the fire grow. And so when they asked about pull it, I'm saying he allowed them to pull out so the fire could get big enough to plausibly take down the building, and then they made damn sure it was going to fall by detonating it. But the arguments that they give about nanothermite and all the rest of it just give me a headache, because I'm like, dude, we have people caught in a van full of bombs. Like, there's no question. Like, why are you leaving that out and analyzing the debris and stuff when we have foreign intelligence assets caught with explosives? There was a team from Jerusalem who illegally did fire prevention work in the World Trade Center, who are arrested and sitting in jail. And the people who hired them, Sergey Denko and Dave Connell, were in court right now for illegally getting fire suppression licenses, heating and plumbing. They had fake companies. I mean, they got caught serendipitously in Tennessee doing fake license. Kali Odala was caught. Catherine Smith is burned to death the day before her trial. Like, all of that. You got a goddamn team doing illegal work on the sprinkler systems in the World Trade Center in the week prior to September 11th. They had a pass on Sakira Hamad's person showing that he was there on September 5th, 6th, 7th. Why are these people in the World Trade Center? Why are they working on the sprinkler systems when nobody had actually hired them to do that, right? They can't explain it, so they go to jail. Like, okay, you've got a team from Jerusalem breaking the fire prevention system. That's what they're actually doing. It didn't work. So who's doing this illegal work, hired by an illegal company that did not have the license, had fake letters of recommendation and all that to create this company to get these patsies to go in and screw up the fire prevention systems? Like, that's not said in the 9/11 kook movement. They're not talking about that story or the people caught with bombs or the van bombs or any of that. They're just like, well, they act like none of that exists, and the only way we can figure it out is by analyzing the debris and seeing if there's some thermite here or something. And I'm like, you guys are fucking stupid. Like, you don't need any of that. That's all extra. We have far more damning Class A arguments, and you're sitting there with your Class F argument. That's my view of it.
Hey, go ahead, Ed.
Let me ask you this. What about the whole, you know, they were running a drill, and where were our fighter planes to take down these passenger planes that were, you know, missing for so many minutes, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, whatever. Can we argue that angle?
No, I mean, this is a good point. Like, they're doing a drill basically almost identical to 9/11 on 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so the jets that should have been scrambled weren't. And, of course, I know you've heard the line, is this real or exercise? And that's another point that fits into my theory, because you've all heard, you know, Mineta was saying, talking about the individual saying, the plane's 30 miles, 40 miles out, 30 miles out. And Dick Cheney saying the orders still stand, the order meaning I'm not giving you an order to shoot. That plane hit the Pentagon, and they want to act like it's Shanksville. I'm like, no, because the Shanksville plane is 40 miles from nothing, much less 30 or 10, like 10 miles from what? It's nowhere near the White House, like they're claiming. The Pentagon plane is, because that's in D.C. It is 30 miles out, 20 miles out. Flight 77, that proves that Cheney was in the POC bunker and refused to shoot down the plane that hit the Pentagon. He would not give the order. Why is Cheney even in position to do it? Because it's supposed to be the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right? Cheney had gotten that power removed from them to himself Well, two, the president who couldn't be found, Donald Rumsfeld couldn't be found, so it went to Cheney rather than the chief of staff where it should have gone. And then Cheney refused to give an order to shoot down. He's like, God damn it, we have to hit the Pentagon. You got to erase the $2.3 trillion that's missing. They physically destroyed the computers. Jack Bryant was on Flight 77. The main investigator into this missing money is on the plane. So they guaranteed – they weren't even going to let him be in the Pentagon. They guaranteed he was getting taken out. They put him on Flight 77 to a flight to California. So he was literally rammed into his own office and killed.
Hey, Ryan,
and
real quick.
He disappeared.
Yeah, Ryan, Sean from Cali, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Nick. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, good, man. What do you got for Ryan here?
Yeah, I just had a couple questions for Ryan. I was just curious. Hey, let me put these dogs out here. Come on. Anyway, sorry about that.
Hey, go ahead.
I like dogs.
Anyway, Ryan, I was curious. Now, you say that an office fire can bring down a steel building. Now, I don't know where you're getting that data from. And, I'm curious about that. I've heard your stuff a lot of times over the years. And I think you have a lot of good information. But I really question that and also a lot of the Pentagon stuff. How is it that a lot of people make a good point. They say, well, if you're going to bring down a building, why use explosives at all? Why don't you just light a fire in it and the whole thing should just fall down, right?
Well, if your story is going to be hijacked planes ran into buildings, you better ram a plane into the building. It's going to be hard to take a plane, make it disappear somehow, and then blow it up with a missile shot from whatever instead, and then put pieces of plane there and get all the witnesses alive. And it's like, it's ridiculous. If you hit the plane, it's no problem. Any plane that can land on a runway can hit the first floor of a building. It's not something
I'm not talking about the Pentagon here. I'm talking about Building 7. You said that an office fire can bring down a building in a symmetrical way. I didn't say in a symmetrical way.
I said about World Trade Center 1 and 2 that the temperatures of flames in a building without any jet fuel are hot enough to melt steel and weaken steel. You only need 550 degrees for steel to lose 50% of its load-bearing strength. At 1,000, you're talking about 90%.
Let me ask you this, okay? Well, let's say that's true for the floors. Let's say that's true for the floors immediately affected. Now, how does that work for the lower floors that were not affected that had increasingly larger steel in them? I mean, how is it that we can?
I don't say fire took down the building. What I'm saying, I've never said fire took down the buildings in any of my films or anything. What I'm saying is, the temperatures of fire are hot enough to melt steel. So when someone says jet fuel can't do it, it's not the open flame temperature of like pouring jet fuel on the ground and lighting it on fire. You can look at Dr. Fire, you can look at independent, don't look at a 9/11 website. Just look at a regular structural website about fires. There are open flame temperatures and there are indoor flame temperatures. Okay. And a lot of the stuff they say about fire, like, oh, look, there's a woman there and she's not burned. Like, you can have fire so hot that it'll burn aluminum cans on a beach or something. You can be 5 feet away and be cold. Like, that's just how it works. But it is hot enough to do it. And indoor flame temperatures reach over 1,200 degrees Celsius, which is way more than what you need to get steel to drop its load. You don't get molten steel until after it falls.
That would be localized. I mean, that wouldn't like affect the entire building.
No, it would affect the whole thing. Yeah, I know. I'm not saying fire took down the building, okay? Let me say that 10 more times. I'm not saying fire took down the building. I'm saying fire is hot enough to melt steel. And so when someone comes with a bad argument that, look, it's impossible for jet fuel to weaken steel to make a floor fall, that is not true. The better argument is what you just said is, well, okay, it is hot enough to make the upper third fall down, but it shouldn't have crashed through all the floors at freeze fall. It should have slowed down or something like that. You can make that argument fine. I'm just picking apart the little part where you say jet fuel's not hot enough is false. It is hot enough. In fact, an indoor fire with no jet fuel is already hot enough if the sprinklers don't respond or anything.
Hey, Sean, did you have another question?
Yeah, I did, if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, go ahead real quick.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm a little annoyed about this a little bit, but the point is, okay, now you have asymmetrical damage. Let's say we had a jet fuel fire that was hot enough to melt the steel. Okay, now, the law of the physics, and of course, no, I'm not, I don't have a PhD, but I am in the building trades. Now, when something starts to fall down, okay, and encounters resistance, it topples to the side. And I like to use the Jenga argument where, like, if you pull the losing tile in the Jenga game, does the whole thing fall into a pile of
dust? Cutting the tree down,
it
falls toward the hole.
Or does it topple to the side, especially when it has asymmetrical damage? Okay, would it fall to the side, or would it fall straight to the center of mass all the way down to the ground? You know, so I think something had to help that building come down. There is no way around it.
Yeah, totally agree.
Okay.
And that's where the truck bombs come in at, that Ryan brings up.
I mean, I don't know what you're hearing. Like I said, like 50 times, I'm not saying fire did take down the building. I'm saying it can. But it wouldn't fall the way it wouldn't fall symmetrically. That's what I said in the beginning.
Well, I think you were talking in context of Building 7, so maybe I got a little off topic. But
Building 7 is a question mark because, yeah, they'll be like, no building ever fell from fire. No building ever had another building fall on top of it either and was allowed to burn for 7 hours without anybody even attempting to put it out. Like, you can't erase that part of the story and act like there's some equivalency when there isn't. That doesn't
mean that it did happen. We're seeing the undamaged side of Building 7.
Right, you're seeing the undamaged side of Building 7 in the morning, not 7 hours later.
No. I'm talking about when the BBC is reporting that it's already fallen, we're seeing the undamaged side of the building.
Yeah, you're seeing the north side.
A complete symmetrical collapse from an asymmetrical fire.
You should fire on
the opposite side of the building.
You shouldn't, but the building actually does fall towards the south side. It doesn't fall straight down. It goes, and then it goes like that towards the south side a little bit. But to me, this is like a stupid issue to ping pong back and forth because it's like splitting hairs about this minutia about, like, well, shouldn't it have fallen a little bit that way more than it did or whatever? It's silly.
Ryan,
to me. I will agree, more damning evidence.
I will agree with you on that. I mean, none of us had access to the evidence. None of us could have an investigation of what happened. So I actually agree with you. I don't agree with you on a lot of what you say, but I agree with you. I think it's more important to figure out who did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If someone sets your house on fire, you don't sit there and go, was it gasoline or kerosene? You say, who set my house on fire? Maybe the guy with a truck full of gas, you know?
Look, but I hear some of this stuff, and I think because these are a lot of the arguments we use to wake people up and bring them into our paradigm, okay? So when I hear a lot of this stuff, kind of like, I don't know, dismissed, I get a little upset about it, only because these are the tools we use to bring people in. Now,
this is my angle.
I agree with you.
You got everybody else talking exclusively about how the buildings fell. And I'm like one of the only guys talking about who did it and the paper trail and the financing and everything I've been talking about for the last 2 hours. So I'm like, I'm going to talk about what I know. And I'm not going to sit here and say the same thing that everyone's already said. I can quote you verbatim all the Jonestown talking points and asymmetric fires and all that shit. I can say it too. But like, you've already heard it, haven't you? Like, disseminated, widespread. So I don't need to repeat shit.
Why do you call people idiots?
Because someone is an idiot if they're saying a missile hit the Pentagon when there's a big plane-sized hole and pieces of a plane in the building.
Well, I haven't seen a lot of that, but I will tell you
there are people saying there are holograms and stuff. That is idiotic.
I know maybe that is idiotic. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
But on 9/11, I heard somebody said it looked like a missile with wings. I heard that on 9/11, way before I even suspected anything. About 9/11. I heard somebody say that in the news before they started controlling it.
Hey, real quick, my cousin.
It looks like a missile with wings, but the thing is, there's debris from that flight, as well as the passengers who were on that flight, still in the building after it crashed. There's no motive to use a missile, and there's no evidence of a missile. And there's not lack of evidence of the plane. There's plenty of evidence for the plane. You just got lied to. Loose Change is financed by an Israeli millionaire, by the way.
Yep.
And so everything they said was bullshit. And they show you exclusively pictures of the second floor and not the first. And the famous picture is the hole with the hose spraying underneath and the smoke and stuff so you can't see the giant gaping hole in the first floor. And I debunked that. I showed that, and they're like, oh, a plane. Like, you can get all the architects and engineers and stuff to agree with you, because if your premise is wrong, your conclusions are wrong. You're like, yeah, a plane doesn't fit an 18-foot hole. No shit. But it's not an 18-foot hole. So into that story.
Hey, Ed, you called back. What would you like to add real quick? We're about to close up pretty soon here. Go ahead.
You got planes flying around for how long? Hour, 45 minutes, 2 hours, four, you know, they can't find them, control towers don't know where they're at, or they're seeing them on the radar going weird places, for, you know, due west and then coming back due east. Our whole Air Force, billion-dollar Air Force that we pay for, was useless. You know, that's my argument. Nobody got in trouble for that.
FAA shredded tapes.
Nobody got in trouble for it. How about that?
Yeah, Ryan just pointed out that the FAA shredded their tapes.
Yep, yeah. And the DTCC, which is where they, it's the location where they do process put options, because this is another thing related to airliners, because a lot of people profited off of it.
Mm-hmm.
There were no subpoenas or anything to them to say, well, who put these put options? We'd like to know, because they're all placing bets exclusively on these airlines and stuff, you know, many magnitudes above the normal range in the stock market, and nobody went to the DTCC and said, you know, here's your subpoena. You're going to have to tell us. We don't have to make it public, but you're going to have to tell a court or something, like, who's making all these put options, because it definitely looks like foreknowledge. Just so we can get those names and investigate them, you know, still innocent until proven guilty. None of that happened. They were not interested in finding out whose put options were placed on these airlines. But, I mean, I think that whole – that's all mob run anyway.
Hey, with the Pentagon, where they released the film where it's just a real quick snippet – that didn't really look like a plane, what they released to the public. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, the thing is, the cameras at the Pentagon are designed to film people and maybe a car in the parking lot. The reason it's like five frames and so shitty is because they're not anticipating anything going 400 miles an hour. I mean, even when you walk, if you run too fast, you'll get a little bit, like the car leaving. They're thinking about that. They're not designed security cameras for airplanes, which is going to cross the entire parking lot in like a second, just going to boom, hit the wall. I mean, you're talking about at least 300 miles an hour.
What about snatching up all the film, the camera film from all the other buildings?
That's actually false, because that's another loose change myth where they say there were 85 cameras. That's bullshit.
Hmm.
The subpoena that they're talking about, it says 85 cameras total. Over 70 some of them are in New York, not the Pentagon.
Okay.
There are only a handful of the Pentagon. The two they had, they did show. The others are like of gas stations and stuff, and they actually didn't catch – they might catch the plume of smoke, but they didn't catch the plane hitting the building because the Pentagon is set lower than all of that, and that's how the plane came in. But you have all the witnesses from 395 and 495 that saw a plane go to the building. No one saw it fly away from the building. Like, the plane is still in the building. You got all the EMTs, all the firemen, all the people that work there, all these witnesses, plus pieces there, Walter Reed Medical Center, DNA of everybody but the five hijackers and a baby. Like, it's definitely a plane. Like, and when you say it's a missile, the people who are at the Pentagon who could have been on our side, like Karen Katowski and people like that, when they hear that shit, they go, that is so stupid. I was there. There was pieces of plane. They have, like, pictures of the debris and the landing gear sitting there in Ring C with the tires and everything that made that punch-out hole that they sometimes act like it's an entrance hole and it's not. I mean, I got film of it in Empire and Mask at the end of it when I'm doing the credits. I show all the water in the Pentagon, the giant gaping fucking hole, like pieces of plane all over the place.
Hey,
like,
hey Ryan.
It was a plane. And I can't, like, I sit here and talk about this Israeli role for an hour and a half. And everyone's like, well, I read a missile. And I'm like, just kill yourself. Like, you're never going to figure out who did it when you can't even, you don't even know how, like, the most basic physical evidence is in denial. Like, no, there were no plane debris. Like, yes, there is. There's photo and video of it and all these witnesses. You're like, no, they're all lying. That was planted there. It's all fake. And that was CGI. And that was a missile. And they put some wings on it or something. Like, I don't know what to say to someone like that. And yes, I will call you an idiot because that is fucking stupid.
Hey, real quick, we got a call from 256.
Yes, I had a comment. I'm here in Alabama. We have a local radio show host here. His name's Dale Jackson, and he's a real, pro-Bush, real, conservative. Mm-hmm. And, I found, what they always try to do is whenever you try to talk about, 9/11 truth, they always try to compare you to Rosie O'Donnell or some liberal, and they try to make you come across as a liberal. So I like Ryan Dawson's approach. I watched his documentary, it really doesn't matter, what there's a thousand different, opinions on, what it was, a hologram or all this, but let's just say we go with the main story, but just keep it simple. The Israelis, what is a fact that nobody can deny is they were filming it, so what I do when I talk to these, rednecks and stuff that hate Muslims, I said, did you know some Middle Easterners were caught with, explosives on the bridge?
Mm-hmm.
And I say Middle Easterners, and I get them, they get interested. I said, yeah, the Middle Easterners, Israel in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
That's how I've been able to get people to start accepting.
That's what happened to Dan Rathers. Dan Rathers went on the Late Show, I think it was Letterman, and he was like, he cried. He broke out in tears and apologized. So he's like, there were some Middle Easterners across the Hudson River filming and celebrating the attacks. Because that's the word he had gotten. But he did not know these Middle Easterners were Israelis. The moment the news learned that these Middle Easterners were Israelis, that story was dropped. You never heard about it again. And I had to do a freedom of information request to get all these files. I had the police reports and the Jewish Daily Forward and newspapers about the event back when I made War by Deception. But when I made Empire and Mass, I had 1,800 pages worth of documents from the FBI on these guys and these moving companies, and found out so much more information, and it tied right into the art student ring and everything else. I'm like, damn, it's more than they just knew about it and filmed it. I mean, they had an active role in it.
Absolutely. And that's why everybody should take a look at the film Empire Unmasked. What is that, $20 right now, Ryan?
Yeah, it's 20, and you don't have to have PayPal to use PayPal. You can use your credit card or Patreon. If you're on Patreon, I gift it to you anyway. So it's $20 either way. If people don't like PayPal, they can use Patreon.
Because we're closing out.
I'd rather put it out free, but it's like I put in years of my life in research. I put War by Deception out free already, and I talk about it on radio shows like this. I'll give you the information, but if you want the film, I have to pay for what it costs me to make that, and that's my livelihood. So eventually, if I earn enough, if I'm stable, I'll release it for free. No problem. I want everybody to know this stuff. But
hey, Ryan, thank you very much for our show tonight. I really appreciate you being on. I also appreciate you putting on Hellstorm on your website as well.
I also interviewed Tom Goodrich, so people can check that out.
Excellent. Hey, everybody, thank you for listening. I really appreciate Ryan being on tonight, and you have a good weekend, the rest of the weekend, Ryan.
Renegade Broadcasting was founded in 2012, ladies and gentlemen. Since that time, Cole Hunt of the Solar Storm has been authoring the Renegade Broadcasting website, producing, directing, and is now running the Renegade Tribune alongside other projects that present to you all of this free content. Free for you, but not free for him. When your life is busy and you don't know how you can help Cole by contributing in some way, Cole can always use a bit of a financial scratch on the back to help out with costs. So please, be generous and donate whatever you can, wherever you can. You can go to renegadebroadcasting.com and click on Kyle's face. This will take you to a donate button. Every little bit helps.